Welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and in this program we talk about the greatest medical and environmental threats to all life, such as nuclear weapons and nuclear power, global warming, ozone depletion, toxic pollution, deforestation, and many other social and political issues that relate to global well-being. So if you love this planet, keep listening. Hello and welcome to If You Love This Planet. My special guest today is Dr. Rhys Holter, a distinguished conservation biologist who describes himself as an earth doctor and a student of anti-aging. For more than 20 years, Dr. Holter has studied nature in both hemispheres. He holds a PhD in subalpine eucalyptus eco-stress tree physiology from the University of Melbourne in Australia. He currently works at the Californian Lutheran University in Thousand Oaks, California. Dr. Holter founded Global Forest Science, a conservation institute that protects fragile ecosystems, short circuits ecological disasters, and produces ecological education for children around the globe. He's also a broadcaster and a best-selling author of 7 books. Dr. Rhys Holter, welcome to If You Love This Planet.
Thank you very much for having me, Helen. I'm thrilled.
Well, last time we spoke, we talked about bees. And we'll get on to bees in a minute because I want to know what your latest thoughts are about bees. But I want to first introduce this wonderful little book called An Insatiable Bark Beetle by Dr. Rhys Holter. And it was published by the Rocky Mountain Books. And it was published when? What date was it published, Rhys?
Just about a month ago, Helen. It's a brand new release, and it's a little book with a big picture snapshot of what is going on physically on our home, planet Earth.
Well, it's a dear little book, and my producer, Jasmine, picked it up this morning and said, "What a book." She said, "That's the nicest book I've ever seen." And you can just hold it in your hand because it's quite small. It's beautifully bound, and it's orange with all sorts of lovely white spots on it. And it's a super little book. So I guess I'm promoting your book, but let's talk about it. I want you to talk about the bark beetle. What is it? What is it doing? Why is it doing it? And all the ramifications of the insatiable bark beetle.
Okay, well basically in nature, we tend to think of a forest as a dynamic system that most people, their first thoughts are to maybe a giant mountain ash forest, maybe a big old Douglas fir forest. Maybe it's a giant old oak forest. And you know, we think big. We think in big things, human beings. But, you know, the real deal is that life is filled with fluid change. And in our forests around the world, fire is a very important mechanism that Mother Nature uses to reset her clock and regenerate everything. We have very successfully, globally, endeavored to stop all fire. And what we have done, particularly in Western North America, but not exclusively, we have created forests that are in need of change. And as we're seeing around the globe, Mother Nature rocks. And anybody who thinks that a human being can tell Mother Nature what to do, I'm telling you what, you ain't seen nothing yet, because these forests and our oceans and our biosphere, everything is striking back in a way. And make no mistake, listeners, make no mistake, scientists from every continent in biology and in life sciences and in atmospheric sciences are lining up by the hundreds of thousands, saying irrefutably that human beings burning our fossil fuels have changed our atmosphere. The debate is over. Done deal. 1 billion temperature sensors 2-3 weeks ago that were examined very closely by Berkeley show that planet Earth is warming. There is no debate. Humans are doing that. And in our forests, what's happened in Western North America, for the first time, Helen, in 300 million years in the illustrious history of conifers. And conifers are it. They've been on our planet for over 300 million years. These bark beetles that naturally occur in the forest because temperatures have risen in Western North America in part over 2 degrees centigrade, that's 3.8 degrees Fahrenheit, above what they were 40 years ago. Hello, in biology, that is enormous. And what has happened are the beetles have not only sped up their life cycle, but in the mountain forest where Mother Nature's cold ecological curtain prevented them from climbing up to 10 to in meters to 3 to 4 thousand meters above sea level. We're talking 12, 13,000, 14,000 feet above sea level. It is so warm, the beetles are in seventh heaven. They have killed billions of mature trees from California to Alaska, from the Yukon to New Mexico, and the entire area in between. We have never witnessed this in forest biology ever before, and the human implications in Western North America are massive because everything comes down to water, and these beautiful mountain forests, the limber pines and the white bark pines, they hold the snow in the winter. They attract it, they hold it, and they release it very slowly in the springtime, which recharges our waterways, and that feeds 50 million human beings. It also stokes some of the mightiest industries on planet Earth. In California, I'll remind the listeners, we're talking about the eighth largest economy on the globe, and we depend on that water, and the entire ecosystems are upside down. And Helen, I am absolutely furious with what's going on in D.C. right now. In our capital city, it's cool to be a class clown and run to represent people and feign that anything is going wrong. Let me give our listeners a great analogy. If you had a sick child and 98 out of 100 expert medical doctors told a responsible parent that the child was ill and these are the four steps that you need to do to save that child's life, I'm going to assure you, every one of those class clowns that's feigning stupidity in D.C. would line up and say, yes, sir, we will do that. And the two contrarians would say, well, you know, maybe the kid's got a fever, maybe he'll be all right, maybe, they would be dismissed immediately. Hundreds of thousands of scientists are lining up right now and saying that human beings are forcing the climate and changing the biosphere and changing life globally, and politicians are going, oh, there's no such thing. Balls, flummery, and we have no time to waste. And kudos to Australia for bringing in a carbon tax, and of course the EU is trying to do their utmost to pulse down. California has AB 32, and by 2020, which is an awful long way away, we're going to pulse down perhaps 25-28% of our carbon emissions based on the 1990 emissions. But this is there is no single issue on planet Earth, perhaps except 7 billion people procreating, that is bigger than human-forced climate change, which is now climate disruption, Helen, because this is impinging upon our ability to grow food and supply humankind.
Right. So would you classify Obama as one of the class clowns?
No, but I would classify the president as a very disappointing captain of the team, because nothing has happened 3.5 to 3+ years of him being at the helm, we have seen no real statement coming out to say, you know, this is what we're going to do. You know, we've got a very, very enormous problem in Alberta, Canada. It's the second biggest hydrocarbon reserve on Earth next to Saudi Arabia. They call it the oil sands. What it really is the tar sands. And they are flipping evil. They're laced with toxicity. They're going to be leveling. They're in the process of leveling an area the size of New York State to get at this gooey oil reserve. They're wasting billions of liters of fresh water, and they're running the gamut of toxifying almost 5% of Earth's fresh water. Our listeners may remember a year ago, there was an awful alumina spill in Hungary on the Danube River. I can assure the listeners that the Hungarian alumina toxicity spill that occurred, the breach of that of the dike that toxified the Danube River over a year ago, will be nothing compared to the 200 settling ponds that are dotted along the Athabasca currently, because they're going to be increasing. And incidentally, Helen, the astronauts from outer space looked down on those 200-plus settling ponds on the Athabasca River laced with arsenic and potent toxicity, and they actually thought they were lakes in northern Alberta. And they run the gamut of toxifying the Mackenzie River that feeds into the Arctic. And until we address that, our 18th century technology of sucking the petrochemicals out of Earth and belching them into the biosphere is not the way to move forward, we are killing Mother Earth, and it is not acceptable. And anybody who tells you otherwise is lying, and they're killing Earth, and they're making life for our children and our grandchildren near impossible in the coming decade.
Well, I was just in Turkey addressing the Turkish Engineers Society, and the president of the International Energy Agency spoke, and he said if things go along as they're going now, which is what you just described in one of the areas, he said by the end of the century, it's going to be 6 degrees centigrade hotter. That is antithetical to life. Certainly to human life, we will not survive, but many other species will not. Would you like to address that prediction, Rhys Halter?
I absolutely will. First of all, I'll say he's missed it by possibly 70 years. I got a report in the middle of the night. I love my Aussie counterparts. They call, they wake me up. They're so excited of what they're finding. And CSIRO Tasmania last week released a report. In 2050, according to last year's data, the oceans are acidifying. They are becoming acidic because as the carbon dioxide is absorbed into the phytoplankton in the ocean, a byproduct of that is a weak carbonic acid, and it's acidifying the oceans faster than it has in the last 60 million years. And 1 year ago, when I chatted with my mate, they told me that by 2050, if you were a shellfish in the Great Southern Ocean, you wouldn't be making a living. And I'm talking that the whales, this affects the entire food chain, incidentally. It's not just the mollusks and the shrimp and the lobsters. This affects everything from the little forms of life and the phytoplankton to the whales. I got a call a week ago that they have just moved up their prediction that based on our fossil fuel emissions, which jumped almost 6% from 2009 to 2010, just released on Sunday, that the acidity will be that intense that by 2030, if you're a shellfish, you're not going to be doing business and living in the Great Southern Ocean. That's 19 years, Helen. This is the most important issue that human beings are faced with. Because make no mistake, listeners, Earth will go on well in for millions more, hundreds of millions more years. It's just what we human beings are doing to our home and how we're going to be able to make a living. And it doesn't look very good right now.
Well, you look, I absolutely love your passion and I feel exactly the same way as you do, but how the hell? And I could use a ruder Australian expression, which I'm not allowed to do over the air. How the hell do we make these bloody, I can say bloody, politicians wake up? What do we have to do to them, Rhys Halter?
Oh, I don't know, but I'm going to say one thing. We have these demonstrations on Wall Street, and we have my brothers, Billy McKibben, my friend and colleague, bless him, that have been protesting at the White House on this foul, evil XL pipeline that they want to run from the tar sands down to America, and those evil, evil former Enron executives that are trying to run a pipeline from Alberta into the bowels of Vancouver and the Burrard Inlet in British Columbia so they can fuel hundreds of super tankers to run over to China to give them oil. It's just not on. And I think that people, if they can protest, I think they got to protest. And I think that each of us can lend a helping hand. And I think if we tighten our belts and we understand that we've got to change the way we do business. Helen, every year in the United States of America, we are punching in 242 million tons of trash into Mother Earth. We are toxifying the lifeblood of this planet, water. And we've got to change how we do business. We've got to reduce what we do. We've got to reuse stuff. And lastly, we got to recycle. You know, Australia, because you've been through a rugged, dry 10 years, you understand the importance of water. You understand how to use less. And the rest of our planet has got to get on this. Now, here's what I wrote a piece in Huffington 3, 5, 7 weeks ago that said, look here, for every problem, there are at least 3 solutions. Now, every town and every city on our planet needs to update and redo the waterway system. Helen, that's jobs. Those are real jobs. We are missing millions and millions of square kilometers of white ice and clouds from my beautiful Ferrari of forest, the Amazon, that makes clouds every day, that's been leveled with climate disruption. We had a 500 million trees blown over in a storm. And I got news for the listeners around the equator. There isn't any wind. The intertropical zone of convergence is windless. And a storm ripped through there 5 years ago that leveled a 500 million trees. And we lost not only the trees, but their ability to make rain and clouds. And so Earth, its natural cooling systems are going away. So what we do, paint every rooftop in the world, as far as I'm concerned, white. Those are real jobs. In America, our forests are overgrown because we've suppressed fire for 100 years. We get people out there with saws in their hands. Those are jobs, and we mimic. We take down some of this overcrowded wood. Jobs. These are real issues. America is hammered with unemployment, and there are ways around our actions. Because here it is, Helen. Our best friend in the 21st century is innovation. And human beings are nothing more or less than tool makers. We solve problems. We don't hoard stuff. We don't thwart innovation. There isn't any problem a human being, an intelligent human being, can't solve. And I got news for the listeners. We've got thousands of colleges around America and around the world, but in America, where we've got concentrated brain power, and we need to throw it open and say, here it is. How do we derive new sources of energy? Are we going to find it tomorrow? No. But are we going to find it within a decade? I would bet my life on it. If we open this up, if we say it's business as usual, we're going into a zone that is so frightening, because forests on every forested continent, Helen, are now dying. They are showing stresses of drought. They are showing, we have beetle infestations here, but we're not the only continent that shows that. Our trees, the life force on this planet, the vanguard of life, and our fresh water are dying. And when they die, you don't need to be a quantum physicist to know that that's a bad sign for all other forms of life. We need to take heed of what is happening, and we need to move on. And supporting a big oil is repugnant. And in this country, this fiscal year, the big five oil companies in the United States of America, this fiscal year, have received have received $21 billion in subsidies this year. And that's just not on. Their profits are soaring. I had the president of Royal Dutch Shell was standing up in the Kara Sea, up in the Arctic, on a podium in tears saying, we spent $2.2 billion looking for oil. I thought, you did not. You were subsidized every dollar. Now, come on.
Okay, so there are several things. One, you think Australia's good. Yeah, we passed a carbon tax bill, but it really doesn't do much at all, Rhys Halter. We are the biggest, almost the biggest exporter of coal in the world. Coal is, of course, dead trees and is a very concentrated form of source of carbon, and we export that to China. China, in the last 2 days, has been such pollution in Beijing that people can't see through the air, and there's been a big outcry about it. But China's going mad, and we're going mad, and they talk about jobs. Number one. Number two, I commissioned a study a couple of years ago called Carbon-Free, Nuclear-Free, written by Dr. Arjun Makajani, which shows that all the available technology that we have now for renewables is cheap, it's easy to make, and we can do it now. In fact, if you look at jobs, America could cover every single roof with solar panels so that every house is independent of the grid, manufactures its own energy. And if you became the leader in production of solar panels and solar hot water systems, it would create hundreds of thousands of jobs. One. Two, you should cover all your parking lots with solar panels. So when you import the electric cars from China, which they're currently making, you power the cars not with nuclear energy or coal, global warming energy, but by solar energy. Number three, there's enough wind west of the Mississippi to supply the whole country with three times as much electricity as it currently uses. Number four, the grid needs to be upgraded. It's very denigrated in the west. It needs to be upgraded. It needs to be a smart grid. There are so many things, and the technology's here, like right now. And you talked about Occupy Wall Street. I actually spoke at Wall Street twice recently, one on the possibility of nuclear war, which hangs over our heads every day like the sword of Damocles, and two, a meltdown at Indian Point Nuclear Reactor. But what I said basically was that they should now occupy Congress, because Congress belongs to the people, of the people, for the people, by the people. And at the moment, because Americans don't choose to vote mostly, which takes my breath away, because in Australia voting is compulsory.
You must.
We have to vote or we get fined, I think, $50. Mm-hmm. Number one. Number two, that even if people do vote, they then leave a vacuum. They don't even know who their congresspeople are, their senators. They don't educate them. They don't go and see them when they come home to their districts. And into that vacuum left by the American people move the corporations. So that vacuum must be now filled by the people and the corporations removed from the vacuum. And that means Occupy Congress in every sense of the word.
Agreed.
Would you like to comment on that?
I couldn't agree more. And, you know, that's the only way that the voice and reason of change will happen.
Yeah.
And the oil companies have done a phenomenal job of smearing and confusing the public that nothing is going on. And in the meantime, the price of food has continued to rise since February of this year, 2011, and will continue to do so because Texas alone, that has a $99 billion agriculture industry, has at least lost 10%. There's $9 billion that's gone, but the number of cattle in America is at a all-time low, and the price of beef has gone up. The ability to deal with corn, to grow corn, and grow other crops has been hampered by wild weather across the southern half of the United States. We've had terrific flooding. As a matter of fact, it now boils down to this. I looked at a study last week. There's $2 billion worth of roadway damages that have been caused by weather calamities in the United States that have not been repaired and may not be repaired for some time. So climate disruption is biting into the infrastructure of our lives, our food and our ability to travel. And this just has to change. And it will. The longer the resistance on the parties who will not yield to what's forthcoming, it means that the Occupy movement will eventually boil and froth over, and people will protest and continue to protest. And it's the only way we can show in a democracy that change is imminent and essential for our well-being.
I'm interviewing Dr. Rhys Halter, a distinguished conservation biologist, who describes himself as an earth doctor. And as he talks, you can see that he is an earth doctor. I'm also a biologist. And the passion with which Dr. Rhys Halter speaks is the passion that I have, and I think all biologists have, who understand the intricacies of the biological systems on the planet, which is, they're so precious, they're so vital, they're so important. So, Rhys, I'd like you to explain what 1 ton of wood, how much carbon is in 1 ton of wood, and how much oxygen does 1 ton of wood in a tree produce?
Well, you know, let me step back even further. Most of our listeners have probably heard or will remember at some point the laws of thermodynamics. Kind of there's 4 or 6 or so principles that we in science and in life need to remember. The most important one is that energy is neither created nor destroyed, in my opinion. And what does that mean? Well, it means that the ancient forest of 300 million years ago that fell down and absorbed weight and heat from the outer mantle that transformed into oil, gas, and coal. Because when you think about it, trees are very clever in that they can, first of all, make all their own food. So they take the energy from the sun, water from our environment, and they fix it into a form of carbon, which we know as wood. And when that wood is burned, a solid then changes into a gas, carbon dioxide, for instance, and this carbon cycle continues to circulate. And so what we need to be thinking about, I think, is that every day on planet Earth right now, we are emitting over 82 million tons of greenhouse gases each day, and they're rising. And they're rising, and the atmosphere is becoming chock-a-block with these gases. The ocean and the land, the forest, and our prairies are the natural absorbing systems for this CO2, this gas that plants can make a living from. But the problems are resulting, as I mentioned earlier, in the oceans, from the fact that the more carbon dioxide there is in the atmosphere, the more acid the oceans are creating, and we are actually missing 40% of the phytoplankton, the base of the entire marine food chain is missing. And our forests around the world are beginning to die. And when the forests die from the beetles and from drought and from other stresses, they, instead of absorbing this CO2, Helen, are emitting it into this rising pool around Earth. And our natural systems to absorb a rising level of CO2 are breaking down. And this is the $64,000 question, in so much as bioengineers are now thinking, well, maybe if we put a big parasol up around parts of planet Earth, we can get a bit of shade and try and reduce the incoming solar radiation, because the white surfaces, the ice and the clouds around the tropical forests that are missing, are not able to reflect this incoming radiation. We're warming up, and it's very, very frightening. So our trees are our best friends, but right now they're trying to tell all of us something, Helen.
Right. Well, as you talked, I just got a vision of something. But I want to start with saying, in your book I read that for every ton of wood, it has absorbed 1.5 tons of carbon and emitted 1 ton of oxygen, because let me explain photosynthesis. In the leaves is chlorophyll, that's the green stuff, and the chlorophyll traps the light from the sun and combines it with, as I'm trying to remember by biology from my high school days, combines it with sugar, doesn't it?
Well, it combines it with the water.
With the water. To make the sugars.
And the sugar is what makes the tree grow, and the sugar is then transformed into wood.
Yes, and the sugar has carbon in it, of course, which is wood.
Yeah, absolutely.
And, but also, out through the leaves is excreted oxygen, which is a byproduct of photosynthesis, and that's what we breathe. Now, as you talked, I suddenly realized that trees are the absolute nidus, if you will, of the whole problem, because it was trees millions and billions of years ago that, when they died, created coal, oil, and natural gas. And as we take out the ancient trees and burn the coal, oil, and natural gas, we're releasing the trapped carbon that the trees, through photosynthesis, trapped millions and billions of years ago. And as we release the carbon into carbon dioxide, which is the global warming heat-trapping gas, so the trees cannot withstand the increase in temperature, and all sorts of nasty bugs like the bark beetle and others attack the trees and they die, number one. Number two, as the trees die, they then, through by becoming compost, really release their own carbon dioxide again. So it's a sort of catch-22. The trees die and release their carbon as carbon dioxide, because we're burning the trapped carbon from millions of years ago underground and releasing carbon dioxide. So it's a vicious circle.
It is. And, you know, remember, life on planet Earth, unfortunately, when you're a human, it's just all about us. And so people are going, this gas, that gas, trees, whatever. The ipso facto is at the end of the day, where we are watching and where we're very concerned is, in one word, drought. And Australia got lambasted by about a 7 or 8 year dry spell that just about put you on your ear. And now we're starting to see drought crop up all over the world. Texas is in, is just past a 1 year mark, and it's the worst drought in modern times. And there are droughts all over the earth on every continent that are ravaging the tree's ability to make a living. And as an eco-stress physiologist, this is where it comes down to. The trees are the most thrifty organisms, big organisms on the globe. And when they reach a tipping point where they can't deal with these kinds of drought stresses, that is the ultimate canary in the coal mine, telling scientists in all disciplines that we are in severe trouble. And let me also drive this point home a little further. We had a dilly of a drought in the 1950s here in the southwest of America. And, in fact, it was a bit longer than this drought, and it's true. It did kill hundreds of millions of trees. But the difference between that 1950s drought and this current drought that ravaged the southwest of America and into Mexico, 70% of Mexico is now in a hell of a drought. Oh. The difference is that when we elevate the temperature by 2 degrees centigrade, it kills trees 2 to 5 times faster in a drought than they can contend with or that happened in the 1950s. Mm. In other words, rising temperature and dry periods, which we call as droughts, are a lethal 1-2 combination.
A sort of a feedback mechanism.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, you're a biologist. I want you to talk about the biology in a forest and the species, the number of species in a square meter of soil, for instance, in a forest. I want you to talk about that.
Yeah, I mean, we have incredible biodiversity. You know, as a conservation biologist, which is a new branch of science, conservation biologists are charged with trying to understand the tapestry of life in the forest or around the globe in the coral reef. We're still trying to identify every species and how they all work together. I think there's a very interesting point here. In nature, because nature has thousands of different factories. You could take a beehive, for instance, of 100,000 individuals in a beehive, mostly females. And there's a food service industry of an exceptional quality, highly profitable, where there is zero unemployment. Everybody works, everybody contributes, everybody eats. And they all work for the common good. And it turns out that all our forests, our Amazon forests, our Pacific Northwest forests, or the beautiful mountain ash, or the blue gum, New South Wales, in these forest communities, all of these organisms work together. And in the soils, the soils are really the decomposition and where all the nutrients are recycled down to every atom. There is 0.0 waste. There's no such thing as waste in nature because every organism along the chain, whether they're building wood as a big tree or whether they're breaking down dead wood, as a bacteria or as a fungus or as any of the soil critters, the scorpions, the millipedes, every organism, including beetles, has a role in our forest to contribute to the life force, You don't need to be a scientist or even really a naturalist to go for a walk with your family or your dog or your friends, and you go into the forest or under a tree on a hot day. First of all, it's cooler. The tree is transpiring and respiring and giving off not only oxygen but moisture, and it is the life force on our planet. Well, and we need it. We need our inner city green spaces. We have to have our wild forests and whatever is left of them, and we have to protect those forests, Helen. And each of us can contribute. Each of us can write our member of parliament or our Congress members, or we can demonstrate, we can march, and we can do little things at our home, because it turns out that our homes are a major source of potentially leaking carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. And there are little things that we can do, like changing our, in America, in Australia, you're all over this and have been for a couple decades, changing our toilets to these ultra-low flow toilets, changing our vegetation around our homes to be more water smart, and watering our gardens. I mean, when it comes down to the drought that you've all been through, you had water rationing. Parts of our continent have had water rationing, which means that we've got to change the way we think and the way we use fresh water. And so we can do that at our home, in our irrigation, and in our all of our new implements, our toilets, our shower heads, the ultra low flow heads. And we can just even being efficient and making sure our furnaces twice a year are cleaned and our filters are changed and they're up to date. Just little things. These aren't spending thousands of dollars can help. And if each family does that, each person and family uses a little less and we're a little smarter, it is all going to contribute. Now, I've had people say, well, this is all very well. It's Australians and Americans and Canadians and Brits and others change the way they're doing business. But what about the billion-plus people from India and the billion-four people in China and their very burgeoning middle class? They want to live the way we in the English parts of the English world have lived. And I don't know the answer to that, Helen, but, you know, I do know one thing, that there has to be a leader. There has to be a country, and America is that country, and they've got to step up to the plate and say, we've got to do business differently, and this is how it's going to play out.
And the American people have to take over Congress and take it back from the corporations. I just want to quote a couple of things from your lovely little book, Dr. Rhys Halter, The Insatiable Bark Beetle. You start off by saying about 10,000 years ago, 50% of Earth's land surface was forested. Today, a little over 25% of the planet is covered with trees. Humans are destroying and polluting the biosphere at an extraordinary rate. In fact, each day we're spewing 82 million metric tons of greenhouse gases into the stratosphere. Yet some of us have the temerity to claim no responsibility for our daily rapacious activities. I love the way you write. And then I want to quote a few things here, that a tree, an average mature tree, pumps about 119 gallons of moisture into the atmosphere every 24 hours through transpiration. And I don't think people understand how trees help to moderate the climate. And then you talk about healthy soil, which is essential for all forest life. Let me just read this because I think it's fascinating. Tree roots actively secrete organic acids and carbohydrates to feed soil fungus, bacteria, and complex soil microfauna. It is the most complex recycling process that we know on the globe. There's no waste. Stated another way, there's zero unemployment. Every organism has a role to play, like you said about the bees. They all eat and reproduce. In a forest in Canada alone, there are 12 species of slugs, slimy herbivores that make up as much as 70% of animal biomass. A square meter of the soil here can support 2,000 earthworms, 40,000 insects, 120,000 mites, 120 million nematodes or worms, and many millions of protozoa and bacteria. They all make a living together, growing and working. They feed, digest, mate and die, all perpetuating the life of the forest. Now that's poetry. And it's what life's about. And I don't think we as anthropocentric beings understand this. And if we don't understand it, we're going to destroy ourselves. But not just that.
Yeah.
The nematodes.
Ellen, it is frightening. Here's in a nutshell, here's life. Life is, there are a number of lessons. We are all sent here. The First Nations believe that everybody has a role. And throughout our lives, we have activities. And we're humans. We make mistakes. If we do not learn from our lessons, of course, we make bigger mistakes. But if we make a mistake, Helen, knowing full well that we're doing the wrong thing, pox on humanity and pox on the outcome. And it's not going to happen on my watch. As long as I'm able to take a breath on this planet, I'm not going to sit around and watch class clowns feign stupidity because somebody is pounding in millions of dollars into wherever it's going to better them. Because here's the thing, Helen, even the pharaohs couldn't figure out how to take their riches with them to the next life. So how many billions does a person need? I don't know. You ask them, and they won't know. But guess what? They can't take it to the next life. And the line on the sand is drawn. And people like Richard Branson, they get it. And they understand that we are headed for endgame if we continue to do business as usual every day. And it's just not on.
You, as a biologist, Dr. Rhys Holter, know a lot. You understand the diversity of life and the interconnectedness of all life. I understand it too as a physician and a biologist. But it seems to me that the average person does not, because they haven't been educated to understand this. So therefore, I would propose that education is the key to saving the planet. And I think it was President Jefferson who once said, an educated democracy will behave in a responsible fashion. Therefore, I think it's up to us, you and me, and all other biologists, to educate the people so they understand innately the complexities of life and how precious it is and how we must preserve that. Would you agree with that notion?
110,000%. And I'm going to tell you this, Helen. I hang out with kids, and I'm going to tell you what. Our children today are smarter than they ever were. They've got bigger brains. They've got to be fed information. They've got to learn how to problem solve, how to critically assess things. And we are also in education. This is not my opinion. This is an ipso facto. We are back in the 19th century. Having children memorize stuff is crap. Integrating this, their beautiful brains. You want children that are going to move forward in the 21st century, I'll tell you what, you teach them biology, you mix the protein, carbohydrate, sterol, and lipid with how to cook that food, what kind of food you're going to be able to afford on a $200 or $150 budget in a week, and you show them that if you eat bad processed sugary corn syrup crap, that you're going to wind up ill and you're going to be somebody who's enslaved to a pharmaceutical for the rest of your life. And exercise is paramount. And kids get this, and if we visually show them, if we empower economics, if we empower food science, if we empower biology, you mix them in the big pot together, and I'll show you children that will be good citizens. Because you are what you eat. And I'm going to tell the listeners, do whatever you can to eat only organic. Eating a little bit of poison every day is wrong. And at some point, our wonderful human body breaks down because we have given it poison, short of having a genetic predisposition.
Now, you are a student of anti-aging. Is this what you're on about?
Yes, absolutely. And this is why our bees are the custodian of life on land. Bees are the life force. Over 74% of 100 crop species that humans eat or wear in terms of cotton every day on planet Earth is because bees pollinate. Bees pollinate almost 70% of over 230,000 kinds of plants on our planet. And they're dying by the billions, Helen, because certain companies are making known poisons and killing them, and they're allowed to make those poisons and kill our bees. And that is not cool.
Well, you could say more than that. It's evil. So are the bees still dying as much as they were last time we spoke about
more,
a year ago?
More, Helen.
Really?
More. In the last 4 years, yeah, a quarter of a trillion honeybees have prematurely died. This is an epic crisis. And incidentally, the healthy populations that were in Australia, allowing Australia to export millions of queen honeybees, have now become infected, and we're in a crisis. Our bees are sick. Our trees are dying. For heaven's sake, you don't need to be a scientist to understand that Mother Earth is saying enough is enough. And you do business the way you used to do business, you 7 billion people, it's not going to be a good outcome. And so we will change. We have the intelligence. We have we amongst a few of us, the leaders, we have the nous to guide our species forward, and we will. Good will supersede evil. And the people that are killing the earth are going to have to pay. That's treason against humanity. And it boils down to this, Helen. These companies, you're either for planet Earth or you're killing planet Earth. And if you're killing planet Earth, you better stand accountable.
Well, on those really fiery statements, we've come to the end of this interview, but I agree with everything you've said, Dr. Rhys Holter, as a biologist, and I think your passion is totally appropriate, and more people need to manifest this passion, this anger, and this outrage, or we're not going to make it. Because if we all sit back comfortably on our couches and doing our Facebooks and watching television, the inevitable will happen. But if we get it into our souls that we're going to save the planet, we will. So I thank you so much for this really quite profound interview, Dr. Holter, and I'm sure we will be talking with you in the future.
Thank you a million, Helen, and bless you for all your great works.
Thank you. Thank you, Rhys.
Bye-bye.
My guest today on If You Love This Planet was author and conservation biologist Dr. Rhys Holter, a really, truly inspirational and mind-blowing interview. We'll be with you again next week with another inspirational interview. Meanwhile, think about what was just said. Learn about it. Read his book called The Insatiable Bark Beetle, Dr. Rhys Holter. You'll find it on the internet. And bye for now.
You've been listening to If You Love This Planet with Dr. Helen Caldicott. This program is broadcast on community radio across the United States, including our host station, KPFT Pacifica, Houston, Texas. This program is produced and engineered by Jazz Williams, co-produced by Scott Powell, and our publicity and outreach are coordinated by Amanda Bellerby. To listen to previous shows or to make a donation, go to our website, ifyoulovethisplanet.org.